Welcome to the Verity Podcast for Wednesday, March 13th, 2024, where we separate the spin from the facts. I'm Scott Wallace.
And I'm Melissa Topshire with today's headlines. Haiti's prime minister resigns amid national instability.
U.S. intelligence leaders say Netanyahu's coalition may be in jeopardy.
Special counsel Robert Hur testifies before the U.S. House in the Biden documents case.
Ukraine-based Russian opposition groups attempt to invade Belgorod.
Thailand's election commission seeks to dissolve the opposition party.
The European Commission says EU-Bosnia accession talks should begin.
Al-Qaeda's Yemen branch announces the death of its leader.
Elon Musk says he'll open source his Grok chatbot.
A Boeing whistleblower is found dead.
And Airbnb bans indoor security cameras.
In our first story, Haiti's prime minister resigns amid national instability. Here are the facts as agreed upon by BBC News, CNN, ABC News, Euronews, Fox News, and Al Jazeera. After meeting with regional leaders in Jamaica on Monday to discuss a political transition in Haiti following a surge in gang violence, Prime Minister Ariel Henry has agreed to step down. In a video posted Monday, Henry announced that his government will resign once a transitional council has been formed, emphasizing the importance of peace for Haiti. Henry's government will serve as a caretaker government until a new prime minister and cabinet are appointed. The violence escalated in late February when Henry postponed elections until August 2025. It also coincided with Henry's journey to Kenya, where he signed an agreement to expedite the UN-approved deployment of 1,000 Kenyan police officers to help restore order in Haiti. Jimmy Cherizier, who is also known as Barbecue and directs the gang federation G9 Family and Allies, said that if the global community continues on its trajectory, it will plunge Haiti into further chaos. The scope of international response is still undefined. Brazil, Canada, France, Mexico, the UN, and the US are discussing assistance for Haiti, only days after the US State Department ordered the Marines to assist US embassy personnel in the Caribbean country. Following discussions among Caribbean nations and other stakeholders, a decision was made to establish an independent college in Haiti. Per U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, the college aims to establish the necessary security environment for conducting free elections.
On this program, we separate the spin from the facts. Melissa laid out the facts for us, and our first spin is a pro-establishment narrative from Al Jazeera. The decision by Prime Minister Ariel Henry to resign signals that he accepts responsibility for the Caribbean nation's grave security situation, but also that he's willing to head the transitional government until a new administration has been elected. The armed gangs have demanded that Henry resign or risk civil war. The regional Caribbean community and common market has offered the necessary tools for a peaceful democratic transition once the UN's multinational security force arrives in Haiti.
And Fox News brings us an establishment critical narrative. The prime minister has done what the gangs have requested him to do. He resigned. However, this does not appear to be sufficient for the gangs, who have pledged to attack any foreign troops. They regard a UN-led multinational security force in Haiti as a provocation. The gangs will not be represented in the presidential college, whose policies might even unintentionally fuel even more violence and riots. Haiti will have to brace itself because it looks like it will get worse before it gets any better.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculus. There is a 69% chance that Haiti will experience a successful coup d'etat before 2040. And I think the big question is how long will the United States accept having an anarchy nation so close to it?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a close boat ride, I'd say.
Yeah. U.S. intelligence reports that Netanyahu's coalition may be in jeopardy. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the New York Times, CNN, the Financial Times, BBC News, and Washington Post. A U.S. intelligence report Monday claimed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing coalition may be in jeopardy, and his resignation and new elections were expected in response to his handling of the Gaza war, predicting a more moderate government coming to power. The report, known as the Annual Threat Assessment, details national security threats for Congress. It also posited that Hamas, with its vast subterranean military infrastructure underneath Gaza, will likely survive as an armed group for years to come. The report signaled doubt that positive governance outcomes by Israel in post-war Gaza were likely. Additionally, the report claimed Iran did not orchestrate or have prior knowledge of Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel. The assessment comes as Netanyahu and U.S. President Joe Biden aired their respective dissatisfaction with each other over the weekend. Biden called Israel's handling of the war over the top, prompting public rebuttals from Netanyahu. In addition, top intelligence officials testified before Congress on Monday about conflicts the U.S. is involved in, namely geopolitical tensions with China and the wars in Gaza and Ukraine. CIA Chief Bill Burns outlined a potential Gaza ceasefire, stressing its necessity to effectively deliver aid and alleviate a hunger crisis the U.N., among others, warns could become a famine.
Thank you, Scott, for the facts. The right narrative comes from Israel Hayom. The aftermath of October 7 has presented quite a challenge to the U.S. and Israel, but the rhetoric being deployed against Netanyahu is unreasonable. The left should not be blaming Netanyahu for October 7 more than Hamas. Criticism of Netanyahu from Biden and other leftists isn't productive and veers toward rewarding Hamas for starting this war.
And the left narrative from the New York Times. There's no way for Israel to regain the moral high ground as long as Netanyahu is in power. Whether his right-wing coalition collapses, the Knesset enacts a vote of constructive no confidence, the opposition withdraws from the unity government, or demonstrators put the heat on him, Netanyahu can't be allowed to keep Israel on its current path. With Netanyahu's popularity at an all-time low, now might be the time to move on from him.
Here's the pro-Palestine narrative from Middle East Eye. Regardless of what administration has run Israel, Palestinians have faced decades of cruel military occupation and collective punishment. So instead of Biden and the mainstream media claiming things will improve if Netanyahu leaves, the focus should be on changing Israel's longtime goal of destroying Palestine and displacing its people.
And the nerd narrative from Metaculus. There's a 15% chance that the International Criminal Court will bring charges against Benjamin Netanyahu before 2026.
Special Counsel Herr testifies for the U.S. House. Here are the facts as agreed upon by USA Today, the Associated Press, The Hill, and CBS. Special Counsel Robert Herr on Tuesday testified before the U.S. House Judiciary Committee over his report on President Joe Biden's handling of classified documents and comments about the president's memory and demeanor found within. This month, Herr released a report recommending the U.S. Department of Justice refrain from charging Biden with crimes over his retention of classified documents after his vice presidency. But Herr also referred to Biden as a well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. A transcript of Herr's interviews with Biden was released Tuesday before the hearing. Featured Biden's claims that he treated the classified documents seriously, but he was reportedly unsure about some dates and details. Early in his testimony, Herr rebutted Representative Jerry Nadler's remark that the report was a total exoneration of Biden by saying the report wasn't an exoneration and the word doesn't even appear in the report. Partisanship was on full display throughout the hearing. The GOP accused Herr, who was selected by the DOJ, of giving Biden a pass, especially in light of former President Donald Trump facing criminal charges for his handling of classified documents. Democrats, on the other hand, contrasted Biden's cooperation with the investigation against Trump's refusal to return the documents. Some Democrats assailed Herr for what they described as smearing the president for the benefit of Republicans' narrative about Biden.
Thanks, Melissa. We have a Democratic narrative on this story from Salon.com. Herr owes Biden an apology for depicting the president as having serious memory lapses, despite that not being the mandate of the investigation. The transcript paints a more nuanced picture of Biden's answers and contradicts some of Herr's claims. Herr was defiant in his testimony, but he could have to answer for his tarnishing of Biden's reputation.
Here's a Republican narrative from Town Hall. Whether Biden is forgetful and elderly is not relevant here, other than the fact that Herr seems to have let Biden off the hook because the special counsel has that impression of the president. Biden's admission that he took the documents willfully was the same explanation Trump gave under questioning, yet Trump is the only one facing criminal charges. Herr needs to better explain this double standard.
And the nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 48% chance that Joe Biden will be reelected president of the United States in 2024. Ukraine-based Russian opposition groups attempt to invade Belgorod. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by BBC, TASS, and CNBC. 3 Ukraine-based Russian rebel groups say they've entered Russia's Belgorod and Kursk regions to help fight Russia. The groups are the Freedom of Russia Legion, the Siberian Battalion, and the Russian Volunteer Corps. Referring to them as Ukrainian sabotage groups, Russian official media reported that border guards stopped multiple attempts to invade Belgorod beginning March 10th. Then at around 3 a.m. Moscow time on March 12th, they tried to enter 3 locations simultaneously: Odnarabovka, Natokayevka, and Spodaryushino. The FRL and SB groups confirmed their involvement on their Telegram accounts, posting that their goal was to take our land away from the Putin regime, centimeter by centimeter. The RDK also appeared to confirm their crossing into Russian territory in its account. While the FRL said it wanted to free Russia from Putin's dictatorship, the SB condemned Russia's presidential election as fiction, claiming you can really change your life for the better only with weapons in your hands. The group say they've overtaken 2 villages. Russia said that throughout the attack on Belgorod, 60 members of the pro-Ukraine groups were killed, with 5 tanks and an armored personnel vehicle destroyed. It added that 1 Russian woman and 1 man were injured during the fighting, as well as damage to buildings and a power line. In Kursk, students were switched to virtual classes due to the paramilitary attacks, with the region's governor confirming that it had been hit by Ukrainian drones overnight, and the border village of Tetkino was bombed later on.
Those were the facts, and here are the narrative spins, beginning with an anti-Russia narrative from Ukraine Forum. Not only have these freedom fighters bravely entered Russian territory, but they've also taken control of multiple border towns, including Tetkino and Lotzovaya Rudka. This attack has been more than successful, forcing Putin's forces to flee and leave behind heavy military equipment.
And RT brings us the pro-Russia narrative. These were not rogue Russian opposition groups, but rather members of the Ukrainian military, supported by Ukrainian tanks and armored vehicles. Despite this being a fully stocked military operation, Russian forces were able to deter each and every one of these invasions, taking out dozens of Ukrainian soldiers and their vehicles.
And here's a nerd narrative from Metaculus saying there's a 1% chance that Ukraine will sever the land bridge between Crimea and Russia before 2025. News from Thailand as the Election Commission seeks to dissolve the opposition party. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Al Jazeera, the Associated Press, Barron's, and Reuters. Thailand's election authority unanimously decided to ask the Constitutional Court to dissolve the Reformist Move Forward Party, or MFP, for violating the prohibition of insulting the royal family. If the court agrees, the party's leaders could be banned from politics for 10 years. The MFP, which won last year's general election, had sought to amend the royal defamation law, to which the court ruled the move unconstitutional. Violating the law can result in up to 15 years in prison, though no one from the MFP was punished. This follows the removal of the Future Forward Party, FFP, in 2020 over charges of financial violations, which prompted large protests in Bangkok, featuring unprecedented amounts of criticism against the Thai monarchy. Since the 2020 remarks against the royal family, whom the Constitution states should be in a position of revered worship, over 260 people have been prosecuted under the law. This included a man sentenced to 50 years in prison over anti-monarchy Facebook posts. Former head of the MFP, Pita Lim Jawrinrat, was barred from serving as prime minister by Senate conservatives, though he was later cleared of alleged election violations in January that could have permanently banned him from politics.
Thanks, Melissa. The Bangkok Post brings us narrative A. While the court is typically on the side of the constitutionalists, this time it might be different, given the result of the court's dissolution of the FFP. The public is growing more in favor of the MFP and PETA, who could very well take charge of the government once the existing Senate term concludes. It's time for the court to consider a more nuanced approach in balancing public criticism with maintaining the monarchy.
And here's narrative B from the Thai Examiner. While the legal actions being taken against the MFP will undoubtedly impact Thai politics and society, the fact of the matter is that PETA's party has been openly encouraging widespread violations of the Constitution. By campaigning on this issue, the MFP has clearly instigated anger toward the constitutionality protected, toward the constitutionally protected royal family, an act that puts the monarchy and its government at risk.
And another nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 60% chance that Thailand will experience a successful coup d'etat before 2040. The European Commission says EU-Bosnia accession talks should begin. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by Reuters, Politico, Euronews, the Associated Press, and Al Jazeera. The European Commission recommended that the European Union commence membership talks with Bosnia and Herzegovina on Tuesday. After first applying for EU membership, Bosnia was granted EU candidate status in December 2022. The European Commission will now give the country a positive recommendation to initiate formal accession negotiations. The recommendation still needs to be approved by the leaders of all 27 EU member states. If the Commission's recommendation is approved, Bosnia and Herzegovina will proceed into the next phase of negotiations, which will likely take several years. Bosnia-Herzegovina is one of six countries in the Balkan region that are in different stages of the accession process. The other nations under review are Albania, Serbia, Kosovo, Montenegro, and North Macedonia. In a speech to the European Parliament, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen praised Bosnia's impressive steps toward meeting EU requirements, saying that more progress has been achieved in just over a year than in over a decade. Bosnia has struggled with persistent ethnic strife and political tension since the end of the 1992-95 war. The conflict killed more than 100,000 and uprooted millions.
Thank you, Scott. We'll start with a pro-establishment narrative from Euronews. While Bosnia is still far from perfect, the country has made impressive progress in adapting to meet the requirements and expectations of EU member states. These concrete steps that Bosnia and Herzegovina have taken show the commitment that the country has to join the EU. During this time of great geopolitical uncertainty in Europe, the bloc must focus on both growth and security. The future of Bosnia and Herzegovina belongs in the EU.
The establishment critical narrative comes from Euractiv. The European Commission continues to send new and unclear requirements for EU membership. Bosnia would likely have a better chance of being approved to join a different intergovernmental organization like BRICS, which pushes back on Western hegemonic aims. Bosnia, as it exists now, has no future. While EU membership is unlikely to come anytime soon, internal ethnic strife is almost certainly imminent.
And there's a nerd narrative from Metaculus saying there's a 50% chance that a West Balkan state will next join the EU by January 2030. I have a Bosnian friend who's in Seattle and in a rock band, pretty good one, a gypsy rock, punk rock band. And I got to be in the music video, which was Ayn Rand focused The Fountainhead. So I played Dominique Francone and it was a blast. It was a blast. Mm. That's my shameless plug.
Nice.
Go watch Culture Shock.
Can do, boss.
In Yemen, an Al-Qaeda branch announces the death of a leader. Here are the facts as agreed upon by BBC News, The New York Times, Rewards for Justice, Times of Israel, Al Jazeera, and The New Arab. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula released a video announcing the death of its leader, Khalid Batarfi, on Monday. The terrorist group has claimed responsibility for attacks in France and the U.S. in 2015 and 2019, which killed 17 people and 3 people, respectively. Commenting on Batarfi's death, Ibrahim Al-Kosi, a senior Sudanese AQAP leader, did not explain how he died, only expressing his heartfelt condolences and sincere regret over his death. He added that Sa'ad bin Atef al-Awlaki had been appointed as Batarfi's successor. Batarfi left for Afghanistan in 1999 and fought alongside the Taliban in 2001 before joining AQAP in 2010 to lead forces in the takeover of Yemen's Abyan province as the emir of Abyan, according to the U.S. The U.S. designated him a global terrorist in 2018. Born in Saudi Arabia, Batarfi believed to be in his early 40s when he died. Succeeded Qassem al-Rimi in 2020, who was killed by a drone strike ordered by then-U.S. President Donald Trump. Washington had put a bounty of $5 million on al-Batarfi's head. According to the Site Intelligence Group, the Sunni group's new leader, al-Awlaki, last appeared in a video published in February 2023. The U.S. has a $6 million bounty on him for having publicly called for attacks against the United States and its allies. A recent UN report estimates the number of active AQAP fighters and passive members to 3,000 to 4,000, noting that despite its decline, AQAP remains the most effective terrorist group in Yemen, plans to operate across the region and beyond.
Thanks, Melissa. We have a pro-establishment narrative from New York Times. Although AQAP continues to pose a serious threat, its ability to carry out attacks outside of Yemen has diminished due to effective U.S. countermeasures. Like Batarfi, his successor is also calling for attacks against the U.S., and the terrorists might exploit the destabilization of Yemen and the region, fueled by the attacks of the Houthis on the Red Sea, to recruit and rebuild. Only if the U.S. continues to take decisive action can it prevent AQAP from restoring its relevance within the jihadist movement.
And responsible statecraft brings us an establishment critical narrative. The death of Batarfi has brought al-Qaeda back into the headlines and needs to be placed in a broader context. The fact that AQAP was able to become the most powerful al-Qaeda branch in the first place is primarily due to the U.S.-backed war on the Saudi-led coalition against the Houthis. The resulting destabilization of Yemen provided the ideal breeding ground for the spread of the Sunni terrorists and declared enemies of the Houthis. That the U.S. is now bombing Yemen is likely to backfire again and bolster both the Houthis and AQAP.
And another nerd narrative from Metaculus. There is a 1.3% chance that the submarine cables running through the Red Sea will be damaged by a hostile actor before March 15th. Musk's Grok chatbot is going open source this week. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by San Francisco County Superior Court, BBC News, Elon Musk's X account, and the corporate X page. Tesla and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk announced Monday on X, formerly known as Twitter, that xAI this week will open source its artificial intelligence AI chatbot, Grok. According to xAI, Grok is a frontier LLM, large language model, connected to real-time data from X. Its stated purpose is to maximally benefit all of humanity and empower research and innovation. Musk has criticized AI companies for not being open-sourced, previously accusing competitor OpenAI of turning into a closed-source, maximum-profit company effectively controlled by Microsoft. While announcing Grok's move to open-source, Musk further alleged that OpenAI was a lie when responding to an account claiming that OpenAI should follow suit. Musk sued OpenAI in February, claiming that the company no longer follows its founding agreement of remaining open-sourced and not-for-profit. Musk helped start OpenAI in 2015 before leaving in 2020. Musk bought X in October 2022 before launching xAI in July 2023.
We'll begin with Narrative A from Gizmodo, Australia. Although Musk's announcement lacks detail, his move to open source Grok further validates his criticism of OpenAI. While tech companies are renowned for shielding their most valuable AI data, it's no secret that OpenAI has reversed its founding mission. Musk's Grok decision is another valid swipe at OpenAI's transition.
Narrative B comes from the San Francisco Chronicle. Musk's attempt to establish himself as a moral leader within the AI sector are disingenuous. The reality is, despite his emphasis on the ethics of technology, the ex-owner often feigns interest in what is good for financial benefit. Musk's intent to defend open-source AI should not be trusted.
And here's another nerd narrative from Metaculus saying there's a 50% chance that Musk will be the richest person in the world by December 2025. A Boeing whistleblower is found dead. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Al Jazeera, Corporate Crime Reporter, The Telegraph, The Daily Mail, NDTV, and The Hill. John Barnett, a 62-year-old former Boeing employee who previously raised safety concerns about the firm's production standards, died from an apparent self-inflicted wound on Saturday in South Carolina. Barnett's lawyer, Brian Knowles, said he was found dead in his truck at a hotel from an alleged self-inflicted gunshot. He was on a break from depositions in a whistleblower lawsuit against Boeing at the time. For 7 years until his retirement in 2017, Barnett worked as a quality control manager at Boeing's Charleston factory. Post-retirement, he sued the firm for allegedly denigrating his character and hampering his career progression because he had raised concerns about production. In January 2024, Barnett warned of production flaws in Boeing's 737 MAX and 787 Dreamliner models. A few days ago, the Federal Aviation Administration said 737 MAX's production had failed 33 of 89 audits. In 2019, he further alleged that Boeing workers had fitted substandard parts to aircraft and claimed that issues with its oxygen system could mean up to 25% of oxygen masks wouldn't work in an emergency. While Boeing has denied Barnett's allegations, an FAA probe found that over 50 non-conforming parts had been lost in the company's system.
Here's our narrative spin, starting with narrative A from News 9 Live. John Barnett's death only adds to the unease surrounding Boeing's safety record. His serious allegations of production flaws blew the lid off entrenched problems that have been affecting the aviation giant's production process for years. Barnett's untimely passing could limit crucial further whistleblowing about Boeing's poor practices.
Here's narrative B from 9 News. John Barnett's allegations about Boeing planes' dysfunctional oxygen masks were baseless and have been addressed satisfactorily. Boeing's equipment system complies with the state-of-the-art design and regulatory requirements. His claims were nothing more than mudslinging from a disgruntled ex-employee.
I was listening to this story on the radio, and they were quick to mention the old adage that flying is still the safest form of travel. And I don't doubt that it is, but are they going to start to have to check those numbers? Like, well, wait a minute here.
Are you asking how bad does flying need to get before people say, I won't do it?
How does this affect your mindset towards flight?
In the long run, what choice do you really have if you're going to try and get across the country or across an ocean?
but there is a level where you would be, you know, if I told you, hey, it's a coin flip that your plane's going to crash, you'd be like, well, I'm not going to fly, period. I'm changing my lifestyle to not fly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think
so
that's going to take a lot of...
But it would, so you're saying we're not close to the point where you would
change your
lifestyle.
You would have to wear me down a lot. I mean, okay. I don't fly much, so it's not really an issue, but.
Right. Okay, good.
You know,
that's what all those
people
said.
You have to wear me down.
Yeah. Airbnb is banning indoor security cameras in its listings. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Business Insider, Sky News, BBC News, CNN, and CBS. Short-term rental platform Airbnb on Monday announced it is banning the use of indoor security cameras in its listings globally, regardless of their location, purpose, or prior disclosure. Currently, Airbnb permits security cameras in common areas if their presence is disclosed in the property's listing. The new rules, which will permit the use of doorbell cameras and noise monitors if disclosed in the listing, will take effect at the end of April. In a statement, Airbnb said the new policy simplifies its approach to restricting the use of security cameras. The company, which began in 2017, also said the new policy isn't expected to affect most of its listings, which includes more than 5 million hosts who use the site.
And here are the spins on our final story with a narrative A coming from TechCrunch. Airbnb is dedicated to listening to its users and providing them with a feeling of security when they rent a property, and also making the rules around privacy and security crystal clear. This will impact a small amount of the listings on the Airbnb site, and moving forward, the company will continue to adapt in response to user feedback.
Narrative B comes from Ars Technica. It's about time Airbnb changed its troubling policy regarding indoor cameras. Now its policy is more in line with its direct competitors and other companies in the hospitality business. However, Airbnb has a disappointing track record when it comes to enforcing some of its policies, so this change can't be judged until we see how the platform handles complaints about or violations of the new policy.
Thank you for listening to the Verity Podcast for Wednesday, March 13th, 2024.
Each day, we use machine learning to read about 5,000 articles from about 100 newspapers and figure out which ones are about the same stories. For each major story, our editorial team then extracts both the key facts that all articles agree on and the key narratives where the articles differ.
To find out more about Verity, visit our website, verity.news, or download our app on the Apple App Store or Google Play. For Scott Wallace, I'm Melissa Topshire, inviting you to join us next time on Verity.